5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the new Panic Room. It's the show other shows want to be, and the show that authors want to be on.
The all-new Panic Room radio show is brought to you by HellboundBooks.com.
Good evening again. I nearly pressed the button. I was enjoying that so much. Love me a bit of Neil Diamond. I don't know why I haven't played him on the show before. I saw him live about 3 years ago now here in Houston, and he was fucking awesome. I mean, he's like a million years old now, but that voice has not changed. He looks wizened a little bit now. He's this little, small, thin little guy, but when he sings, it's like, wow. You know, I absolutely love the guy. Anywho, it is Thursday night, 9:30 Central, the new Panic Room episode 108, dear Lord. I remember when it was episode 8 back in the good old days. But I'm gonna. You know, and I've missed. I say every week, and I do miss a week. We don't. We don't speak as often as we used to because we're just so busy. I'm busy. She's sleeping, to be honest with you. But so it kind of gives us the whole 24-hour thing because, you know, when I'm sleeping, she's awake, and when I'm awake, she's sleeping. So it kind of works, really. So it's all a bit frightening. But I'm going to give her the full. She needs the full intro, I think, this week. So here we go. And with that terrific intro, it's my old mate Mucker Extina. Well, how was that?
Eddie.
How was that, my dear? Was that good? hey. So, I'm gonna, you know, I'm gonna break the confidence here. Rather tragically, listeners, Extina, she's out of wine. which is, so I'm going to get, if somebody can get Bob Geldof on the phone to organise Wine Aid, then maybe we could do that. That would be great. We could have all the greats on status quo, queen, apart from the fact that most of them are dead now. But, you know, we could do that. Modern band. Do you know, I don't know any modern bands, to be honest with you. I know Katy Perry, Lady Gaga. Ariana, I know all the Megan. I'm a big Megan Trainor fan, actually. She's great, but all the ones about my daughter Chanel. She's listening to some very, what's the word, vulgar lyrics, actually. And so we do that because her. So well, my brother, she said, my brother put me onto this. Oh, seriously, thank you, dude. You know, I mean, for as well as I try to keep away from such things, and I don't really try not.
Oh,
hard,
yeah.
Well, that's
say,
it. You can't shelter them. I mean, they're going to, you know, it's typical of a brother, that, you know, but it's rude. So they say fuck song. Big deal. Mm. You know, I mean, it's just like there are worse things going on this in the world at the moment without
no,
that.
Yeah, yeah. No,
just
I
words.
Agree.
Yeah. You know, so it was. And it was funny. We went.
I like Taylor Swift. I like Taylor Swift.
Taylor Swift
don't tell
is pretty good.
That's like a secret.
No, hey,
yeah.
Taylor's good. Yeah. Carly Rae Jepsen, I'm a bit of a fan of. Ariana Grande is phenomenal.
I don't like her.
You
no,
do
I
not.
Don't
she
like
was
her.
Brilliant.
She's
she
rude.
Did,
I don't like
rude.
Her.
No, I like
That's,
Ariana.
Yeah, I think she's rude.
I'm a big fan of knowing her from. Victorious and then Sam and Kat. Yeah, sort of.
Uh-huh.
It's a bit sad I know all this stuff. And it's not because I'm some sort of pedophile. I've been bringing up a daughter for 9 years. So, you know, I've gone from Paw Patrol to Sesame Street to Paw Patrol. We still watch SpongeBob. And it was funny, actually, because I put the TV on for a bit about. I thought she was coming downstairs, put the TV on, and a new SpongeBob came on. So I sat down to watch it, and it sort of dawned on me. I'm sat watching it because it's a new SpongeBob. I've not seen it before. She was still upstairs. So it's just me watching.
And you were
watching.
The
worst thing is, I thought, I'll make myself a coffee. I paused it. I paused it so I could go make myself my coffee. So I didn't miss it.
That's bad. Yeah, that is bad.
I mean, but it is so good. I mean, it's so, you know, speaking from a writer's point of view, it's so incredibly well written. It is absolutely littered with grown-up gags. I mean, they have references to stuff that just kids, I mean, stuff like the original 60s Batman, you know, and nods to that, and the kids just, huh? But it's, you know, for our generation, it works. It's great, you know, but it was funny, actually. I was talking to somebody at the weekend about, you know, my favourite TV show, what we've got favourited on DVD, you know. And I said, well, obviously, the SpongeBob and obviously Family Guy, American Dad, The Simpsons. It's all cartoons. It is all cartoons, rather frighteningly.
No. I'm not a fan of any of those, really. My kids were crazy into SpongeBob when they were younger. But, you know, I was reminiscing with my daughter recently and remembering some of the kid shows that she used to watch. And do you remember Bear in the Big Blue House? Like, I mean, our kids are different ages. So
maybe that didn't... I might have. It might have made its way across the pond, but not one we watched.
I still remember the theme song. Like I started singing it to her. She was like, "Oh my gosh, I remember that."
Yeah.
Welcome to the Blue House.
Ring a vague bell, but I don't think it was one that we watched a lot of because it was a lot of Brit stuff we watched over there. Obviously, Sesame Street is a constant. My oldest, who is now in his mid-20s, started watching Sesame Street. So I've spent the last 26 years, to be fair, the little one, she grew out of Sesame Street when she was about, she seemed to go from Sesame Street to SpongeBob to Archer pretty quick, actually.
Wow.
So, I don't know what, I mean, how did that happen, you know, but... It was only yesterday we were on the air. It was last night, was it?
Yes.
This is now a nightly show, which is interesting. It'd be interesting. God, that'd be dull, wouldn't it? Us on every night. Jesus Christ.
Well, I don't know how we did Wednesdays. Wednesdays were 2 hours. Oh my gosh, that was torture. I mean, I don't.
Wednesday afternoons,
for 2 hours.
Not my decision.
Yeah.
It was not my decision.
First
thing we did when we took over the show was change the fucking time.
Yep.
You know, so
never
looked
back.
Now people listen in, which is all rather kind of the point, really, isn't it? So. I turned up. Actually, I was a bit late. I turned up at like literally 2 minutes before the show started. I was busy doing. I don't know what I was doing, so I was just buggering about. Actually, I was working on the app, funnily enough, on the Hellbound Books app. I've been updating that and looking at giving it a bit of a revamp to go hand in hand with the revamp. Oh, hang on. Tell you what, if we're going to do that, we need to do this, don't we?
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
Well, I'll tell you what's new, pussycat. We'll be... what a great segue. We'll be launching our new website, hopefully, at the end of the month. It's been sort of... worked on for the past all summer, actually. It's been worked on and it's just about good to go. And it is, I know you've had a sneaky peek.
Looks amazing. I can't wait.
How sexy. Awesome. I mean, I love the old website, but it was only ever meant to be, you know, to get us going and all the rest of it. And it's great. I love it. I love the old, but this is just like a whole different level. I mean, it's just. I'm excited.
I agree with you. When you mentioned, you know, revamping the website, I was thinking, what's wrong with the old website? It looks badass. I don't know, you know, but Yeah, the new one is, wow, it looks really great, and I can't wait to unveil that to everybody. So,
me too. It's another step completely. So I'm excited. So that's what's new, Pussycat. To answer Tom's question there. So hey, what have we got? What's going on tonight? Just let me know. I've just turned up.
I'm excited. We're going to speak with producer and director Brett McCormick. I think we should have the applause and the clap and stuff right then. That's when you should push the button. That's when I say that, but you don't.
Oh,
you
sorry. Well, let's do it again. What's on the show this evening?
We have producer and director.
We can edit it in post. You're all right. Go on.
You never do. You say that all the time, and you never do. We have producer and director Brett McCormick. Woo!
And if all things being equal, he should be there now. Are you with us, sir?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes, Brett, we can. Can you hear me, more importantly?
Oh, yes, I hear you very clearly.
Oh, good, 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 good. So, hey, I don't think Xtina did you justice, to be quite honest with you. I don't think she realized we are in the presence of a schlock god, I have to say. Replicator.
I googled
I saw Replicator, one of my favorite films, I have to say. List as long as your arm of movie credits. Obviously, Replicator, Biotech Warrior, Cyberstalker. I'm reading them now, so there's that many. Attack of the Redneck Mutants is a favourite as well, and The Abomination, of course. So, I'm humbled. Absolutely,
yeah.
I'm a little bit in awe. So, Brett, speak.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. I'm really glad that you enjoy the movies, but James, that makes you a member of a very exclusive club.
I'm proud to be a member of that club. I really am. I mean, I think like a lot of horror fans, obviously I'm pretty much as old as God now, but a lot of horror fans, the 80s was the pinnacle of horror, really. I mean, it gave us Clive Barker, David Cronenberg. It gave us some brilliant, brilliant movies and all. And back in England, we had what were known as the Video Nasties. It was funny, actually. The government listed 10 videos that they were going to ban. Obviously, Cannibal Holocaust was one of them. Evil Dead, the original, was one of them. So me and my friends made it our mission before they were banned to make sure we saw them all. I think we missed one, which I only caught up with quite recently. But a lot of them, when you look at the likes of, Critters and Basket Case, that's the sort of nostalgia that Brett's work puts us in mind of. I mean, is it something that's always fascinated you, Brett?
A lot of people jumped into making very over-the-top, very cheap horror films in the 80s because of the home video explosion. I think that's what fueled the whole explosion of really wild, over-the-top. Of course, everyone's trying to outdo everyone else.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was a big fan of a lot of the, I think Italian horror, which was, like you say, it was just gore. I mean, very little plot.
Dario Argento.
Yeah, I loved his stuff. Oh, badly dubbed as well, which was great.
Which is even better.
It added to the whole experience. Me and my mates, we'd be like, what were we about the time? 15, 16, 17, and we'd bag a few beers and go around to somebody's. My friend, his aunt, because video VCRs were not that commonplace, but my friend's aunt had one of the old top loading ones. Remember those? The old top loaders with the remote.
Absolutely.
The remote was on a wire. Yeah, the remote was actually on a wire that you get up to go to the toilet and somebody would trip over the wire every time.
Right. And
you know,
my kids
kept
dropping things down into the VCR.
Yeah, Toast. Toast is a good one. Or Action Man. So G.I. Joe's head in there. Just,
right.
You know.
Bits and pieces of toys.
Wow.
Yes. Coins as well. I mean, I had a friend of mine who had three young kids at the time, and it was forever in the repair shop with coins and bits of Legos stuck in it.
That was our house, yeah.
Yeah. So what? I mean, obviously you mentioned Dario Argento. I mean, what was your biggest influences back in those days?
I grew up near Dallas, and there was from the 50s forward. There was a whole slew of local Schlockmeisters who were putting out things that I would go see at the drive-in or on late-night TV. These were people like Larry Buchanan and S.F. Brownrigg and Tom Moore and Larry Stoper. And because I knew they were local, I was very inspired to jump in the arena and do something of my own.
Fantastic. Well, how difficult was it for you to do that?
Well, it wasn't all that difficult. It was the first couple of films I made, we really had difficulty finding a reputable distributor for them. So they got put out there, and we really didn't make a lot of money. But by the time I had made my fourth film, then there were several people out on the West Coast who were like, who's this guy in Dallas doing these things so cheap? Let's hire him. So pretty quickly I was able to get ongoing gigs from people like David Winters over at Action International Pictures, and I did a couple of films for Roger Corman. And these were people who just wanted a program to fill a slot on a release schedule, and they liked that we were able to get them done so inexpensively here.
Oh, fantastic.
It was a business. It was a business. It's not really an inspirational, artistic kind of a story, but that's exploitation cinema.
No, that's funny. Sorry, you meant Roger Corman. I mean, obviously, I guess he's the god of schlock. I mean, what was it like to work with him?
He showed up the first couple of days of shooting, came down to Fort Worth, hung out with us, told us we were doing a great job, said he wished that they were still able to go out on the streets and shoot in a random fashion out in Los Angeles. Of course, you have to have a permit for everything out there, and we were just sort of running around town shooting wherever we wanted, and
without a permit.
Probably harken back to his old days, you know.
Yeah. Oh, you just did guerrilla filming, yeah? Did you ever get arrested doing that?
I never got arrested, and there were many times when I probably should have been arrested. There was a time in Poolville, Texas, where I had Randy Moore working with me. He's a very well-known effects guy, worked on a lot of big films for Oliver Stone, worked on the original RoboCop. We needed a shot of a flare for the film Armed for Action, and he's like, it's too windy out here, I can't do the flare. And I said, well, we're on such a tight schedule, we have to do the flare or cut it from the film, so shoot the flare. He shot the flare, it came down in a farmer's field, and we burned up about 3 acres of this guy's property before the fire department showed up. And it worked out serendipitously. The farmer said, oh, I was needing to burn that part of my land off anyway, clear the brush. And fire department just said, I thought the fire department was going to write me all sorts of citations and give me fines, and they just said, don't do that anymore. So we love that.
That is awesome. Wow. That is awesome. I like that, yeah. I mean, I think if you did that now, you'd probably be in jail, to be honest with you.
I definitely would have been fined heavily, and I would have had difficulty getting insurance on productions after that.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, I know. I mean, I sort of dabbled in the movie scene here in Houston, which is, as you know, Brett'll know, I mean, it's really not anything much to write home about. But you know, and to make the next step, you know, to go make an indie movie, insurance is just a killer. I mean, you've got to have some financial backing, because nobody will do anything. Oh, you've got to be insured, and it can be a massive slab of your budget just to cover your ass, literally.
Right.
You know, and mm-hmm. you know, you get cases like we had the one, was it a couple of years ago, where they were shooting on a railway track and the girl got killed because they didn't get off the track fast enough and they'd not had permission. And that set up a whole new set of laws, and things just even tightened up even more. I think the director actually went, I think the producer went to prison for that, for negligible homicide.
Right.
But yeah, it kind of kills it, you know. Say again.
How does that even happen? You know, they're very loud, and you know, how do you?
As I understand it, I think they were filming on a bridge, and they were filming. They hadn't got permission, in so much as so. You know, they hadn't actually spoken to the railroad people to say, well, you know, there will be trains coming by. And I think they were shifting all the equipment off the track and that, and I think she just didn't get off quick enough. If she's trapped on a bridge, I guess she got hit, and that was that, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it, to be fair, it's a film, you know. I mean, people do die on film sets. It does happen from time to time. But when it was something so grossly negligent, in so much as they've not even got permission and all the rest of it, I'm not sure where his insurance sat, but yeah, he ended up in prison somebody ended up going to prison for that, so not so good, but
I had an urban legend book once, and it was talking about deaths on like movie sets or something, and one of them was talking about Wizard of Oz, and that like one of the Munchkins or something hung themselves, and there's a shot of it or something.
I think that is an urban myth. However, the guy who originally played the Tin Man was terribly allergic to the aluminium paint that they painted on him, so they had to change him. And apparently in the scene in the poppy fields when it's snowing, they actually used asbestos. They used asbestos flakes for the snow. And they don't know how he got sick and died on the back of that. So, I read an interesting story. I think it was the Misfits, a John Wayne film with John, was it John Wayne and Marilyn Monroe? And they filmed that because it was cheap to film there.
No,
and they filmed
Clark
it.
Gable.
Clark Gable, sorry, yes, it was Clark Gable. They filmed it where the atomic testing grounds, and they reckon that's what. And I think John Wayne, he filmed something somewhere radioactive, and he died of stomach cancer. Yeah. So they thought they'd kill all these people. So back in the good old days. Anyway, look, I'm waffling on. We do have a caller, so hopefully it's somebody. Hopefully it's not Nick. Nick Passione, then I'd love to speak to Nick, to be honest with you. But let's see who we've got, shall we? Hello, listener. Are you there?
I'm here. Yes.
Hello. Do you have a question for Brett?
Oh, I just wanted to comment. I'm a fan of Mr. McCormick's work, and he also made some action films, too, that weren't, you know, horror-linked. One was Highway to Hell with Richard Harrison. That was a Peplum star and Spaghetti Western star. And then he made one with Dan Haggerty called Macon County War.
Wow, you mean as in Grizzly Adams, yeah? He was the guy who played Grizzly Adams. I remember that show.
Yeah. And also, he made another one. Now, he didn't use his name. And it's, I think it's called Reanimator Academy. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of that one?
I haven't.
Brett may have. Have you heard of that one, Brett?
Oh, yes, I've heard of it.
Yep.
Guilty as charged.
Yes, well, see, you know, it was interesting. He has an effect in there where a guy gets decapitated.
Oh, wow.
Wow, yeah.
Well, were you impressed with the effect?
Well, I would have been more effect had Connie pulled her punch and not hit me square in the jaw, Brett. It's Tom Fagan.
Yes, this caller is an old high school friend of mine, Tom Fagan from Fort Worth, Texas.
I was in four of his movies.
Oh, fantastic.
And
so, what is Brett like to work with then as a director? Spill the beans.
He's superb. Brett stays in control. And, and he also takes care of his people and all that. I mean, when I read about these so-called independent film directors that, you know, get the big budgets and all that, and I'm thinking, you know, we were the real independents. We were out there in the elements. Our craft service was in an ice chest full of cold-cut sandwiches. And, you know, it was just a lot of fun. That was back in the heyday when they were going to try to make Dallas a new next Hollywood. And I don't know if it could have been a next Hollywood. It could have been a very active industry, though. But unfortunately, Trammell Crowe they got greedy. There was one major studio that was coming in, and they wouldn't give them a break on the rent. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Oh.
I'm curious about this decapitation scene now. I think I need to see it.
Well, it's on YouTube. It's on, and you can't miss me. I get decapitated, and it was my last. It was my last movie because, like I say, I came, I saw, and then I got married. My now ex-wife, she didn't want me to act anymore, so. You know, that's just what happened. Yeah,
life does get in the way, I'm afraid, of fun.
Right,
mostly.
But no, Brett's a great. Brett's always been talented. He's a great writer. He's always. I've always been impressed with his stuff, and I've seen his other stuff afterwards. I got Biotech Warrior, which I do suggest everyone watch. That's just a fine, fine sci-fi film.
Uh huh.
So.
I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed Replicator, I have to say. I mean, it was just so wildly out there. I mean, you know, I mean, I've got to ask, I mean, where did you get the idea for that one from?
Well, we were shooting films at a place called Remington York over in Dallas, and we had done a movie called Time Tracers with Jeffrey Combs. And we had some standing, and we had a refrigerator full of short ends of film left over. And I asked one of the editors at Remington York if he could write a script in a week's time, and he did. And what it was Replicator. I wasn't at all expecting that, but I didn't really give him any parameters. He just I said, if you can write it in a week and we can shoot it in a week, let's move forward. So he was a very
fantastic,
talented man named Keith Jornes. He ended up doing some pretty good work out in Los Angeles after that.
Oh, brilliant. So thank you for calling in. Hello?
You bet. Enjoying the show.
Thank you.
Take care, buddy.
Yeah,
enjoy. Compliments, Tom. Checks in the mail.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Awesome. Not every day you get to decapitate your friends, I guess, but I suppose in the movie business,
that
anything
was
goes.
One of the perks of the job. I got to decapitate everyone.
Excellent, excellent. I do like a good... In fact, for me, I mean, probably my favorite decapitation scene is in the original Omen.
That's one of my favorites.
With the sheet of glass, and that was just phenomenal.
Yeah.
So incredibly well done, and wasn't it? Timing was just, I must admit, I wasn't a big fan of the remake, and I don't think they didn't redo that scene as it was, but that was brilliant. That was just so incredible. You knew something was going to happen. It was just wow.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not a big fan of remakes, as anybody listens to the show knows.
You know, they're not bad. Not all of them are bad, but there are definitely some that are you just don't need. I think that's the point, the ones that they're just not needed because the original was just so amazing. Or, you know,
yeah.
If they do a remake that is too close to the original, then you're just like, why even bother?
Well,
you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I only found out because I was actually on the IMDb website. Browsing, and then they've remade Papillon, which was the original film, originally with Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman, which is an absolute classic. Why the hell have they remade it? What more can they add to that story? I mean, seriously?
I don't know. Yeah. I think the reasoning in Hollywood is that if there has already been a film and if it already did decent business, they're automatically a leg up on the marketing of the film because people will immediately recognize the title, and some people will just come see it out of curiosity. So rather than a totally new property where they have to sell it from the ground up.
Yeah.
You know.
Plus, they don't have to pay for a new script because they already own the copy of the rights to it. I mean, I think it may be, you know, the same as, I mean, the old pop groups. You know, you get... funnily enough, Carlos Colon, who's one of our authors and a great guy, rubbed my nose in it a bit. He actually got to see ELO, the Electric Light Orchestra, the other day. And you've got all these 50s, 60s, 70s bands doing the rounds and riding the nostalgia wave. And maybe that's why these old films. Then, well, let's remake Papillon, let's remake Poltergeist, let's remake the Omen. And it's a show that really what they should do is just polish up the old movies and redistribute them because they are always so far superior to the remake. The remakes are just so dull.
Well, I was thinking of Carrie. They've redone that twice, haven't they? I'm pretty sure they've redone it twice now, and both times they've just sucked.
I think there was only one. They made a music out of it, which was funny, but I'm not sure about. They may have made a TV series or something. Oh, they did make a sequel, but the remake with Chloe Grace Moretz was awful.
I swear there was.
I mean,
one
she just.
That,
the thing is, I mean, Sissy Spacek. I mean, has that look. I mean, she looks odd. Chloe.
Yeah, she was definitely in her ascendancy when that film first came out.
Yeah. But Chloe Grace Moretz.
Of course, the character in the original novel is a very large girl, very overweight girl. So Sissy Spacek was definitely a departure in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. But
she just
looked right. She just looked. She wasn't not a classic beauty. I mean, she's an attractive girl, I guess, but she just didn't look cute. She looked odd.
Right.
She looked like the sort of girl.
Sympathy.
Yeah, the sort of girl that as a bully you would pick on, you know.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I'm struggling to think. It's funny enough, actually, and it was just, I am a big Bruce Willis fan. I will confess, I actually watched the remake of Death Wish. I mean, the original Death Wish again, and I saw the original not quite recently. Actually, I wanted to see it again, the Michael Winner version, and the new. I actually enjoyed. I was expecting it to be dire. But it was pretty good. I mean, they changed a lot of things around and blah de blah, but it was just Bruce Willis going around killing people. I just love Bruce. I don't think he can do wrong in my book.
He
just doesn't. Did you see the Comedy Central roast of Bruce Willis, by the way? Did you see that,
Brett? Was it good?
It was awesome. They were merciless. They really. They even got Demi Moore on as well, and she was pretty merciless as well.
Oh, cool.
But he just took it all in good humor. He's just like, I'm Bruce fucking Willis. I don't care. He actually, quote unquote, I'm Bruce fucking Willis. I don't care. Say what you want. You know.
Right.
Perfect.
You know. Great, great guy.
Die Hard is the traditional Christmas Eve film here in our household.
I know, right? You know, it's funny. It's funny he actually made a point of saying, I want to clear this up, Die Hard is not a Christmas movie.
But it is.
It's nice, because it's set at Christmas. It's like
right.
Gremlins. I mean, Gremlins is not a Christmas movie, but people think it is.
There was another movie I remember. It was Gina Davis and Samuel L. Jackson was in it, The Long Kiss Goodnight. And it starts out with, you know, there's a Christmas song. And for some reason, I always think of, you know, Christmas when I see this movie. And it's not anything about Christmas at all, but it has that feel.
It just happens to be.
Starts out. Yeah.
It happens to be set at Christmas. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, a good Christmas movie, I mean, our Christmas movie is National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. And I must have seen it a dozen times. It is still funny. It is still
fun.
That is a Christmas movie. You know, and then there's the classics like.
I like the Santa Claus with Tim Allen. I do. I love that.
Yeah. What's the one what's the one that has white
the
Christmas,
Christmas
in it?
Christmas Story,
yeah. Elf.
Story's a good one.
I actually watched Elf for the first time we made a change actually last year. And I'm not a big Will Ferrell fan, but I really enjoyed that.
I don't like him.
I really enjoyed that one. That was good.
Who liked Bad Santa?
Me.
I
love Billy Bob Thornton, but I actually have Bad Santa too, but I am so anally retentive that I will not watch it until it's Christmas. I can't watch Christmas movies unless it's Christmas.
Yeah, me neither. There was one year that they, I don't even know what station it was, but it played Bad Santa on repeat the whole day. And guess who watched Bad Santa all day long? Me.
Was it you?
All day long, yes.
Fantastic.
I was like, this is awesome. Yes.
Have any of you seen an old film done by Bob Clark called Black Christmas?
Is that a horror film?
It was the first film. It came out in 1974. It was the first film that dealt with the idea of an obscene phone caller who's a killer, but he happens to be calling you from within your own house.
Do you know, it does ring a vague bell. I may have seen it when I was in my teens, but it does ring a bell.
Right. Yeah.
It was one of the first films featuring Margot Kidder. I remember as a kid, I saw that film and I thought she was a hottie.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, she was in her day. She was, I mean, dead now, obviously, but yeah. It's true.
Oh, it is, yeah, yeah.
So,
Brett,
I mean, sorry, Xena, shut up. Brett, again, just throwing these names around. You work with Jeffrey Combs?
I did three movies with Jeff Combs.
I'm going to ask him. Mean, what? He seems like a really weird guy. I mean, is he just his persona? Is he weird? Real life.
He is a very weird guy, a very consummate actor. He's a lot of fun to talk with, had a lot of great behind the scenes stories to tell. He was he played a scientist for us in Time Tracers, and actually I only did two films with him, but I was instrumental in helping him get a job in another film as well. He did a movie with us that was originally called Cyber Stalker, but was later changed. Title was changed to The Digital Prophet, and in that he plays a real psychotic sort of comic book artist guy, and he was brilliant.
Awesome. Well, I hate to say this, but we have to take a short break. It's the end of our first segment here, so you stay with us, and we will be back in a few minutes, okay?
Very good. Thank you.
Keep talking. I haven't found the button yet. For the past 3 weeks I've pressed the wrong damn button. I'm just determined not to do that again. So
I have found it.
It is. People will be phoning in, so you press the right button, I'm gonna complain it. You know, but so here we are. We'll be right back after
this.
Panic Room Radio Show is sponsored by Hellbound Books, purveyors of all manner of dark fiction. You can find the publisher along with links to all their available works across platforms at hellboundbookspublishing.com. Hellbound Books is proud to be the first in the indie publishing business with their very own app on both Google Play and the App Store. In the mood for something steamy to read, check out new erotica author Jennifer Lynn's website at jenniferlynnerotica.com. You can find James at his website, www.jameslongmore.com, and Xtina has an author page found on the Hellbound website. Don't forget to follow the Panic Room Radio Show on social media. Our Facebook page, Unofficial The Panic Room Radio Show, Twitter at Panic Room Radio, our YouTube channel, The New Panic Room Radio Show, and come visit our website at www.panicroomradio.com.
But you know, it's funny. I was watching. I think it was The Handmaid's Tale recommended by someone. Long story, but not what I think I mentioned last week. Not what I have you seen it, Xtina?
I haven't, but I want to. I've also
recommended. Yeah, well, yeah, by me.
No, other people too.
I finished watching Sense8, which was brilliant, and they're going to cancel that. And I'd heard a lot about Handmaid's Tale. I mean, it's won literally every award known to man. And I thought it was a period drama because the picture of the girl, the lady with sort of the oldie styly hat on.
I thought it was something
like Downton Abbey. And I'm not big on period dramas, to be honest.
Right.
My thing. And then said, no, it's not. It's set in a dystopian future thing.
And it's pretty good, huh?
I'm binge watching it. I think I'm episode 5 now, and it's fantastic. I think that song was on it. I have not heard the Walker Brothers song for so long. So we've heard it now, so I'm excited by that. But I would recommend it. Handmaid's Tale is so far so good. I mean, it's pretty brutal in places, but it's a great psychological sort of
I will try. I started Sharp Objects. You mentioned
Sharp Objects. Yeah, is that panning out well?
I'm only in episode 2, but it's my own fault. Like, I just don't watch anything. I swear I don't watch anything. So
it's because you're always sleeping. You're always sleeping.
Because I'm always sleeping.
anywho, we have our usual segment, but sadly Becky can't be. Because she's unwell. Get well soon, Becky, if you're listening.
Yes,
we're gonna do this.
Oh hey, looks like it's time to review something. Oh no!
and then.
Oh, I was like, what are you doing? Yes. That was good.
Xtina can actually answer this question. Xtina, what movie is that the theme tune for?
Jaws! Yay!
Yay! You've actually seen it!
I watched Jaws.
What do you think? I loved it.
I loved it. I did. It was so suspenseful in places. I remember squealing. I remember saying no a few times. and then the scene at the end where Jaws was like eating that guy, you know, like starting with his legs. I pulled my legs up underneath me, and that was so I loved it. I did. I really did. I loved the suspense. There was even a part in the beginning, kind of ish, where I thought something was going to happen, so I was on the edge of my seat, and it didn't. So it was like one of those, we're going to make you think something's about to happen, but it's really not. And so that was great. I absolutely loved the suspense. You know, it's a great departure from the stuff that, these days the movies, they just give you everything right out, right out of the gate. There's no build up, and there's no I don't know. It was great. It really was. I really enjoyed it.
It's a classic. It's like what we were saying with Brett earlier. I mean, it's almost like there's a handful, literally, of perfect movies. I mean, I think Jaws is one.
Yeah.
I would say Back to the Future is another one. I probably struggle to name more than a few, actually.
Yeah.
I see seriously hope they don't remake it. Just do not remake it. But it is, I mean, it's, I mean, 1975, I went to see that at the movies when it came out, probably before you were born, or you were one.
I was born in 74, I was one.
I went to see that, and it was probably just, wow, that is what influenced me, and I wanted to, you know, wow, I want to do that, you know, I want to either make the movies, I want to write them up, whatever, that's, I want to do that, you know, and, but I mean, all credit to Spielberg, you know, he had a mechanical shark, to be fair, that looked mechanical. I mean, nowadays, they would CGI it. But it didn't matter.
Right.
It meant that he kept a lot of it hidden. Which was a great technique that Ridley Scott adopted when he did Alien, where you only saw, you know, for most of the film, you saw bits of it.
And
that's
it was
what,
so
I mean,
bad.
Now, like you say,
yeah.
You
yeah,
see the whole
yeah.
shark, and it's obviously a computer-generated one, and but that, and like I said, and I think the biggest factor that made it such a success, the characters, they had character.
Yeah.
They weren't just disposable.
Yeah.
No, he's going to be, you know, they were absolute proper people.
So I, of course, posted it on Facebook that I was about to watch Jaws for the first time, and I had a whole bunch of people that said that famous line, you know, you're going to need a bigger boat. And, you know, they're like, you'll get it after you watch the movie. And when that scene happened, and the sheriff dude goes backing up, and he's like, you're going to need it. That was a great scene. That was, I mean, I was
yeah.
It was great. I loved that. I did. I was right there. My heart was pounding, and it was great. I loved
apparently, Roy Scheider actually, I mean, it's probably the most iconic line in the movie. He had lived that, apparently. Urban myth has
it. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Huh.
You know, and it was. But, like you say, you know, and to contrast with that, before we bring Brett Hart back on, I actually watched Sharknado 6 on Monday, I think. I DVR'd it and watched it on. I watched it Sunday night, I think it was. And it was as you would expect, to be honest. Although it was less about sharks for me. The sharks were sort of bit players in it. It was all about time travel. It was very confusing. And they brought back all the old characters who you thought were dead, and then back to it, and it was just like, great, you know. But you know it's not the last one.
No,
it's going to be, they'll bring it back.
I keep hearing that the movie The Meg is pretty good. A Facebook friend of mine said it was so scary.
Yeah.
The jump scares are so scary. She almost left that, and she's a horror fan too.
Yeah.
Oh
wow.
So.
Yeah, I fancy that. I mean, I love creature movies. Shark. I mean, it's like a, you know, Jaws but bigger. I mean, it's like huge picture. The kids didn't want to see it. I went to see Slender Man instead. With my daughter, and she wants to see The Nun at the weekend as well. As she gets old, she's going to go for roller coasters. She just likes to be scared. She loves that jump scare moment, that adrenaline rush. So, bit of a junkie, adrenaline junkie, but The Meg, that looks good. I'll probably end up watching that when it comes out.
As far as Jaws goes, I would give it a solid 10. I'm gonna do it in Becky style though and say I'm gonna give it a 9.999. Did I do that good?
999. Yeah, that was brilliant. It was like having Becky in the room. It really was. So hey, let's bring Brett back. Hey Brett, how you doing? Are you still there, sir?
I am still here.
Good.
And I'm doing fine.
No, Xtina, I mean, you know, bearing in mind the business she in, she only saw Jaws like this past week. And,
I know.
She only saw Hellraiser because I bullied her into it. I mean,
he bullies me into everything. He actually muted me on, you know, our show. He muted me last week because I confessed to have never seen Jaws. So I thought it was very mean, by the way.
How did you like Hellraiser?
I loved it. I did. It was great. It was very it's very unique, very different. I liked it. I did. Yeah, I don't know if I want to see the sequels just because I think that, you know, sometimes, especially with those kind of movies that they just, you know, like the Friday the 13th or, you know,
yeah.
Nightmare and
I just get
too much. So.
I would say Hellraiser 2 was good. It was pretty much more of the same but more gruesome. And I mean, Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth, I mean, it was slated. I thoroughly enjoyed that. And then they got patchy after that. Did you see the most recent one, Brett?
No, I haven't. In fact, I've only seen the first one.
Wow.
Oh, right. Wow. I should mute you as well. For, okay.
Yeah.
Mute me.
Make my day. Yeah.
But I think Clive
Barker has a very opened up a new door into horror that was missing before. His people, many of his characters seem to dread the horror they're calling down upon themselves, but they just can't help themselves. They're sort of like addicted to the pain and the suffering and all of the weirdness that goes into opening up a portal into hell.
I think for me, I mean, like I was saying this, I mean, I saw Hellraiser when it came out on VHS back in the early 80s. Late 80s, I do apologize. I watched it and then literally rewound it, as you have to wait for it to rewind, and watched it straight after again. I've seen it many times since. And yeah, it was just so, I think coming at the end of the 80s on top of all the schlock stuff that we were talking about earlier, you know, it was so refreshing. I mean, yeah, it was gruesome. But I think for me, it was that mix of pleasure and pain, that it wasn't just teenagers getting stabbed by a maniac. You know, they brought this upon themselves. They wanted this. And it was that blurring of the boundaries between pleasure and pain, which, neurologically speaking, is the two are very, very close together, that really fascinated me. I'd say the sequels are sort of hit and miss after three, but I've sat through all of them. Even the most recent one.
I have often wondered if the Hellbound Heart was inspiration for the naming of your publishing company.
Funnily enough, yes, it was. Yeah, it was a play on words. Obviously, Hellbound, yeah, from Hellbound Heart, and obviously Hellbound because bookbinding, so it kind of works
right.
On two levels. But yes, well spotted. It was absolutely right. Yeah, I hope I don't get sued now.
No, of course not.
Which, you know, speaking of books, we should talk about, you know, the book. Doesn't it drop tomorrow? Isn't it? Is it tomorrow?
Yes, it does.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I was pretty sure.
Well, you
I
should
have to
be,
say,
because, you know, it's your company, so you really should be up on this sort of thing. We've discussed this before, haven't we?
We have. You know, it's funny when you did the little What's New Pussycat thing, I was thinking to myself, damn, I really should have, you know, again this week, you know, really started to look to see what was new. But then I thought, no, it's funner this way when, you know, I really have no idea what's new. I don't. But anyway, I was going to say that the book, Schlock Horror, I read it, and I loved every one of the stories. They were so good. I was so impressed with them. So I definitely want to say good on Brett for picking out amazing stories.
I was impressed with the amount of really good stories we got. I had co-edited a couple of anthologies before, and we did not get the volume or the quality of the submissions that we received on Slock Horror, and I was very pleased. And I want to thank James for coming up with the concept for the book and the title and asking me to become involved with it. I had a lot of fun reading all of the stories that were submitted, and there were many good stories that we weren't able to include.
Yeah, I must admit, I mean, thank you for, you know, for deciding for taking the plunge with us. But yeah, I mean, it must have been difficult. You know, I've seen, I obviously, the volume we got through, I mean, it must be difficult to discard some of them. I mean, some we say you had to, otherwise the book wouldn't have been. It could have been three volumes, but how tough was that job for you?
It wasn't a tough job because I really enjoyed reading the stories. I think as we got down to the end, I sort of prioritized them by the, you know, how well they floated my boat. We had some really strange, sort of off the scale stories. One that comes to mind is Black Sun House by James B. Pepe. That was a truly inspired glimpse of just a twisted vision that continued to haunt me for days after I read the story. And another one I really liked was called The Return of Mr. Shovel by Andrew Post.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
That was a good one. Yeah. Yeah. And obviously there was the flying dentist was an absolute... An instant
the
classic.
Flying Dentist is an incredibly well-written, very unusual story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was most impressed. I mean, there have been times that I've been tasked with the job of maybe putting the stories in order, you know, and I do remember thinking as I was reading the stories in schlock, that I could not have, like, you know, I would go through and I'd be like, well, this one is, you know, 1, 2, and 3. And I go, well, this is a 1, this is a 2, you know, and I could not have done that with the stories in schlock. I'm glad I did not have that job to figure out which order to put them in or anything like that, because they were all just so good.
You bring up a question that I'm very interested in hearing your answer to. When it comes to an anthology, I've been reading horror anthologies since I was a little boy. When it comes to anthologies, how important do you feel the order of the stories is? Do you feel that readers pick up an anthology and read it from cover to cover? Or do others, like me, hop around just picking titles that appeal to them, or maybe picking one that's short enough to fill the available time that I have for reading, you know?
Now, personally, I would read it cover to cover. So, you know, in you want to engage your reader, so you want to start with something amazing and make them want to go to the next one. And so I think it is pretty important to have, you know, a couple of, like, amazing stories right in the beginning. And then, you know, and I'm not going to say bad stories, because I've never, you know, I would never put a bad story in an anthology. But there are definitely ones that are stronger. So I always want to start with really strong ones, and I always want to end, again, with something that will make them close the book and go, wow, you know. You have to definitely leave them with that wow factor, but I do think it's very important. Yeah, the order.
I'm like Christina. I write an anthology like I would treat, you know, a novel. I will start at the beginning and plow through. You know, and, yeah, you're right. I mean, you start strong, finish strong, but like I said, schlock is just strong. It's all the way through. I don't think there's anything that
it is.
You know.
Because really
even when you read, like, for example, a Stephen King collection, you know, there's some in there that are, you know, not as strong as others, you know?
Of course.
You know, but, to answer the question, Brett, you know, I think the order is important.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that I had the input of the experienced staff at Hellbound Books to make sure that the order was done appropriately.
Yeah.
And I think the one thing that I really did like that Brett did was to tweak the titles to make them more 80s schlocky. And it added an element to, I think, as well. But it just takes you right back to the good old 80s of, you know, sort of, you know, killer vampire virgins from hell sort of type. And that probably is a film to top of my head, I probably watched that.
Yeah. When I was really beginning to get involved in film as a prospective career, it was very common in those days I saw a lot of the films at drive-in theaters, and it was very common for the same film to appear under three different titles. And oftentimes they would take a fairly mundane film and give it an incredibly over-the-top title that would lure you in. And I thought it would be fun to kind of give these short stories in the anthology over-the-top titles and sort of B-movie taglines to go along with them.
No, I mean, again, that was another absolute stroke of genius, you know, that it just added to the whole flavor of the book, you know. So, and like, you're right. I mean, some of the movies, and it's funny how things come around nowadays when you're obviously with an eye on Amazon and digital books and all the rest of it. Picking a title, there's an absolute science to that now. Picking your title and your subtitle and your metadata.
Yeah.
We just actually invested in a nifty bit of software called Kindle Rocket, and it takes a lot of the ball ache out of that for you. And it will suggest titles, it will suggest keywords, it will suggest your AMS key, and it does a lot of that for you, which is great. And it's that important because that's a really clever title, but if people are not going to find it, or it's not going to attract people. So sometimes you have to sort of abandon the really clever, you know, I'm really smart title and give it something like, zombie vampire Frankenstein from hell in bikinis. Which is a film I would sit and watch, to be honest with you. I mean, yeah, definitely. And it's probably a film that Brett would have made. I like to think.
you're right? Quite right. I would have.
So for the reading for the excerpt this week, Brett was going to read us the foreword to Schlock Horror, and I have to say, that was the first thing, of course, I read when reading.
Well,
Schlock
it would be, wouldn't it?
Cover to cover.
Yeah, exactly. So, would you be so kind as to read the foreword to us, Brett?
I would absolutely love to. I don't know how many listeners we have out there, but I thought this would very clearly set up the intent and sort of rationale for this particular anthology.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
This is the foreword. What the hell is schlock? People who love words are constantly playing with definitions and variations on usage. I'm no exception. The original meaning of the Yiddish word roughly approximated trash or shoddy goods. It was not a compliment to be called a schlockmeister. I decided long ago that schlock was not a bad word. I like it. To me, it describes a certain type of raw, deceptively crude-seeming art, music, literature, or cinema that more often than not defies any notion of good taste. I am a schlockmeister. In 1966, when I was 8 years old, I received my introduction to the battle between schlock and good taste. It was a cool winter evening when my mother and her good friend Marilyn packed us four kids into the car and visited the Mansfield Twin Drive-In Theater in Fort Worth, Texas. The ladies wanted to see a pair of Doris Day movies, Send Me No Flowers and Do Not Disturb. We kids were an unfortunate obligation on the excursion. I'm sure the ladies would have preferred to hire a babysitter and see the films with their husbands, but those two were probably as excited about Doris Day as I was. I stared out the rear window of the vehicle watching The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad playing on the other screen. For the life of me, I couldn't imagine why our mothers had not chosen the obviously superior entertainment at the other end of the drive-in. When the stop-motion creatures would appear, I'd add my own sound effects. That is, until Mom told me to knock it off. At intermission time, my lesson in taste began. Halfway through the double bill, we ventured into the snack bar to purchase popcorn and allow those in need to use the facilities. While Mom and Marilyn herded the younger kids into the restrooms, I waited by the door. It was here I received my first introduction to schlock. In a glass-covered frame marked Coming Soon was a delightfully garish poster for a flick called Blood of Ghastly Horror. Though I did not notice it at the time, this was also my introduction to Al Adamson, schlockmeister par excellence. I couldn't take my eyes off the poster, and as soon as Mom returned, I asked if we'd be seeing that movie. No! Mom eyed the atrocity askance and stared me down in a manner implying I'd lost what little sense I may have previously possessed. Why not? It's just, she struggled for an appropriate descriptor. Her face wore the expression of disgust normally reserved for the unexpected discovery of a dirty diaper. Failing to think of a word suitably condemning, she settled for trash. What do you mean? I was legitimately confused. I'd never before heard the word trash used in this context. Trash was what I carried to the curb on Tuesdays and Fridays. Did she mean they'd be throwing this wonderful artifact out for the garbage men? I'd have been glad to take it off their hands free of charge. When I pressed for a fuller explanation, she told me to drop the matter, threatening to withhold my ration of popcorn. It took persistence on my part to acquire further info on this enigma. Over the next few weeks, whenever I caught Mom in a good mood, I'd put forth a nonchalant inquiry. Finally, I had gathered the following knowledge. Good filmmakers, decent humans, went to a great deal of effort and expense to produce the sort of movies that promoted the values our family espoused. B, some really sleazy bad guys would throw together inexpensive crap which appealed to the baser appetites of inferior humans. C, if I ever watched an abomination like Blood of Ghastly Horror, I would enter the ranks of subhumans and lose what little standing I had in society. And I didn't want that, did I? The meaning of the title remained a mystery, and I'm pretty sure my mom was right on that point. It wasn't so much a title as a pastiche of trigger words. I remained intrigued by the idea that adults could actually earn money generating such wordplay. A foolhardy young lad, I imagined I was willing to risk being labeled a cretin, a mutant, a person with poor taste. Time passed, and I discovered the underground comics of Robert Crumb and others. I stumbled onto the cinematic perversions of Andy Milligan. I listened to the counterculture music of Rocky Erickson and the 13th Floor Elevators. I even took in John Landis's first film, Schlock, though I still had no understanding of the word's etymology or connotation at the time. I learned that even a fairly innocuous film like M.A. Rip's Bayou could be reclassified as schlock by the inclusion of a single shot of nudity and a title change to the more lurid Poor White Trash. The world seemed overflowing with forbidden fruit, and I was inextricably drawn to it. In 1979, I happened onto a book called Kings of the Bees, and it was a chapter dedicated to the career of one Sam Katzman. Here I got the lowdown on the whole schlock thing. The author even called Sam a schlockmeister, but the moniker did not seem entirely derisive. I recognized Katzman's films. I'd grown up watching them. What's more, I still appreciated many of them, even as an adult. Something in me longed to follow in the schlocky footsteps of Mr. Sam Katzman. From 1984 until 1996, I wrote, produced, and directed a slew of no-budget indie flicks for international home video distribution. The drive-ins had died, but the home video market created demand for the same sort of schlocky fare. Instead of watching a movie or two a week, as Americans had for decades, many were watching five or more videos every weekend. Before I knew it, I had become one of the trash purveyors my mother warned me about on that chilly winter evening in 1966. Today, there is a solid niche market for films my mother's generation would have condemned. Even major Hollywood studios have journeyed into turf previously ruled only by the meanest of schlockmeisters. It is common for modern viewers to rationalize their guilty cinematic pleasures by using such phrases as, it's so bad, it's good, or other non sequiturs. To my way of thinking, you needn't apologize or explain. Schlock films are fruit of the same tree that gave us punk rock, body art, piercings, Picasso, underground comics, graffiti, taxidermy, carnival sideshows, and literary oddities like the ones you'll find in this book. Enjoy.
That was great. I love that.
Brilliant.
I did.
Beautifully read. Beautiful.
Thank you.
So if Brett could be up for the audiobook version, I think, we'll make him read all of it.
Yes.
Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yes, it would.
Oh.
No, I'm being serious now. That would be great.
Yeah. So, you know, we definitely have to hear Brett's embarrassing story. He has an embarrassing story for us. And, you know, most of the time our guests do not share with me or, you know, even hint around with me what it's about. But, you know, a couple key words, and I was like, we have definitely got to have time for the embarrassing story. So you have
awesome.
A little... The button ready? You have the button.
Oh, I've got to press the button now. But do you know?
Yeah.
You work me too hard. You really do. Here we go.
I'm Patty, and I'm Thelma. What is your most embarrassing story?
Nice button pushing.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say this is my most embarrassing story, but it's like a very early one in my career as a writer. I can vividly remember one evening when I was about 10 years old, my mother and my great aunt, a lady we called Margaret Ann, were talking about the books they'd read. And as they were talking and discussing different authors, it became clear to me that some of these authors were making a lot of money doing what they were doing. And so I asked them if there were any authors who specialized in scary stuff, because I was the scary stuff kid of the family. I was watching all of the horror films and all of that sort of thing. And they said, yeah, there are. What came to mind immediately for both of them was Edgar Allan Poe. And I'd never heard the name, of course, and they were concerned that he might be a little above my reading level, but they both encouraged me and told me I was a bright kid and whatnot. So I went quickly to my bedroom and got a little notebook and decided I was going to be a horror writer. I started writing a horror story that night, and I wrote down the name of the writer they had mentioned, so that when I went to the library the next time, which was a weekly occurrence in our home, that I could check out a book by this guy. So I went to the card catalog thinking I'm this exceptionally bright 10-year-old kid, and I go looking up the guy's name, and I can't find it. So I go to the reference department and ask the head librarian, do you have books by Edgar Allan Poe? And they said, of course we do, young man. Are you going to read them? They thought I was a little young. And I said, yeah. And so we walked back over to the card catalog, and I said, I've been looking all through here, and I can't find it. And she said, well, some people misspelled the Allen part. It's A-L-L-A-N, not E-N, but I don't think that would have tripped you up, did it? And I looked at my card, and I must have had this embarrassed look on my face. And she said, let me see what you wrote. And she took the card that I had with me out of my hand and looked at it. And she goes, oh, this is rich. Do you mind if I keep this? And before I could say anything, she walked off with my note. What I had heard with my young Texan ears was Ed, first name Ed, middle name Growlin, like growling with the G left off, last name Poe. And, you know, it made perfect sense to me because I heard of Howlin' Wolf on the radio, the blues performer, and Wolfman Jack, and I just thought it was some adult kind of a nickname that the guy would have taken. And so she walked off with it. I felt really, really stupid. And I imagine they had a bulletin board in the back of the library where they hung up all the really stupid things that people yeah. brought in, and that I would be at the top of the list.
That's awesome. I love love that.
I like that. Egg growling. So cool. I like that.
You're doing that thing, James. You're doing that Just, I'm telling you, it never fails. No matter what, he does this demonic, robotic voice every single week. And I think we actually should name the demon guy. I do. But I believe, anyway, that we are just about out of time. And we had so much fun on the show. You have to promise to come back and see us.
Thank you, guys. I had fun.
You have to promise. I promise to come back and see you. You have to say it like
I promise to come back and see you. Yes, I will. And I like the demonic robotic voice.
Right. It is great, but I just can't understand it too much. But I do think we need to name him. Like, I'm thinking Frank or something like that. I think it would sound really good.
I'm very convinced that demons are just waiting for us to develop artificial intelligence so that they can inhabit all of our machines.
Rise of the machines. Yeah, definitely. Again, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. And if anybody wants to stalk Brett, they can go to our Facebook page. We have his links put up there. And I will definitely be getting with you to have you come back on the show because this has been a lot of fun. And I do think this is about the time of night when James tells me to say goodnight, Xtina. So goodnight, Xtina.
Goodnight, Xtina.
Stopped going, the whole world shook, the storm was blowing through you. Waiting for God to stop this and up to your neck. In darkness, everyone around you was corrupted. Say something. There's no dignity in death to sell the world your last breath. You're still fighting over everything you left. Oh, I saw you standing at the gate when Marlon Brando passed away. You had that look.
Advertise.